talk about reproductive technology in cattle. It's certainly a favorite subject of mine. There's a few things that I'd like to talk about on the agenda, just to give you a quick overview of Transova Genetics, primarily to understand our company and where I'm coming from with some of the views that I might have on reproductive technology. I'd like to review some of the current reproductive technologies that are presently in place, as well as then have a discussion on some of the emerging technologies as well. First of all, Transova Genetics really has three operating divisions. We have an ag embryo transfer division, which has been really our core business that serves ag customers, primarily seed stock breeders, several of which I recognize a lot of faces in the out there from times when I was doing collection and transfer work. We also have a dairy services division, primarily working with commercial dairy producers, trying to provide reproductive and genetic solutions for commercial dairymen. And then our Genetic Advancement Center, where we've been working to produce transgenic livestock for the production of pharmaceuticals in either milk or blood, really with two projects there, one with the production of human serum albumin in the milk of transgenic cows, and then working with Dr. Robel and Hematech for the production of cattle which have the ability to produce human polyclonal antibodies, and he'll go into that, I'm sure, in a lot greater detail. We have a number of business locations scattered around. The red stars represent locations where we have embryo collection centers. The blue stars, we have sites where we actually harvest oocytes from slaughterhouse facilities. And then the yellow star representing our what we call the Genetic Advancement Center, Research and Development Center. Our core business has been the collection and transfer of embryos, both from beef and dairy customers. However, about 95% of our business is beef cattle. We're talking about the work we do for our seed stock customers with the production of either in vivo or in vitro embryos, either embryos we've collected from superovulated cows or embryos we're going to collect via aspiration of follicles, with our real goal being able to increase the genetic impact of superior females. And certainly this is something that we've been doing for a long time. And in fact, this slide was taken in the early 80s. And along the way, we've added some new tools to the toolbox, so to speak, and yet really the goal of what we attempt to do in that division remains much the same. We house and manage client-owned donors. We're not in the genetics business. We're a service company in that ag division. These happen to be donors that are at our Chillicothe, Missouri location. We also do work on farms and ranches. We maintain about 3,000 to 4,000 recipient cows that are available for implant of embryos. Our customers' embryos, some of which would be embryos from Hematech, for example, with Dr. Robel, as well as a lot of our ag customers as well. Embryo export every year, we'll export a couple thousand embryos to various parts around the globe. We do embryo micromanipulation, splitting biopsy, microinjection, one of the early ways to produce transgenics, for example, ultrasonography for diagnostics, fetal sexing, oocyte retrieval. So those are all some of the things we do in our ag division on a daily basis. What we call our Genetic Advancement Center that we started in about 1997 was really the mission of being able to be a delivery system, so to speak, of bioproteins. And by bioproteins, we're talking about the ability to take cows and introduce a gene that would cause them to produce a protein in either their milk or blood, such as the human serum albumin or polyclonal antibodies. But in addition to that, we've always had a vision that we'd like to take those same technologies and, when appropriate, be able to apply those back into animal agriculture. And with our roots being in animal agriculture, and particularly beef cattle production, is an area that, of course, is of great interest to us. And we like to really look at that, what we call a Genetic Advancement Center, is really a bioprotein bridge, so to speak, where we start with technology partners over on our left side and marketing partners on the right. We're certainly not what we consider to be a primary bench research and development company, nor are we a pharmaceutical production company, for example. But there's a number of steps in between, and we try to help fill as many of those steps in the gap between those technology partners and marketing partners as possible. And in addition to that, there's some core competencies in animal welfare, quality assurance, regulatory compliance that are extremely important when one looks at the ability to have cows that are going to produce a pharmaceutical product. And so that kind of summarizes what we attempt to do at the Genetic Advancement Center. In what we call our dairy division, which is really an emerging division for us, we really looked at the dairy farms in the in our area, and what we could see is that they really need to have improved reproductive efficiencies. They need heifers, and we looked at value propositions that we thought our company could bring, and those are really conception rate, the ability to create female offspring, and then sustainable crossbreeding programs. If you look at the dairy industry, it's really in an earthquake, so to speak. There used to be a lot of 50 to 250 cow herds in our immediate area here. I'm from about 60 miles away from Sioux Falls. There were a lot of those in this area we considered to really be an earthquake, and that now what's left are 1,000 to 5,000 cow herds. And it's interesting when you look at dairy production that it's about the only protein-producing animal species that primarily relies on purebred livestock. And so there's some opportunities to take some of the technologies we'll talk about later and bundle those and serve that industry. Moving on to what we call the animal biotechnology toolbox, particularly from a reproductive standpoint, I'm going to talk about some tools, some of which are old tools and some of which are certainly new tools. And what we find is the old tools certainly don't go away. They're not necessarily replaced. And certainly one of the older tools, of course, is artificial insemination. And my part of my take-home message here is that certainly these things aren't going to go away. In addition to that, that sometimes newer technologies come along to really help those who have greater utilization. If we look at artificial insemination technology and know-how was around for a long time before it penetrated the market, but it really took the ability to be able to freeze or cryopreserve semen and store that semen and distribute it before it become a significant, have a significant impact on beef and dairy industries. Synchronization of estrus is another one that was very important for its utilization, progeny testing. And so, so there's some of these things that come along and then other technologies come along and really help move them along. And I think we'll see this as we move through. Estrus synchronization, certainly we're going to talk about cutting edge reproductive biotechnology. It doesn't sound like a very exciting thing to talk about. And yet if we look at kind of the history of estrus synchronization, nearly 30 years ago, prostaglandins came along and gave us the ability to synchronize estrus fairly efficiently with products like Lutalyse and Estromate. We could have 50 to 65% synchronization efficiencies. Some ovulation control things came along, the ability to use GnRH, gonadotropin-releasing hormone, coupled with Estromate, the so-called OvSync programs that you hear about. And those certainly also helped improve some efficiencies so that maybe we could have 70% synchronization efficiencies. And then the progesterones, so to speak, came along. Earlier Synchrovate B, but now the products called Cedars that I'm sure a lot of you have heard about, those have come along and they've also helped improve synchronization efficiency. But when we put some of those together and in combination using products like GnRH and Cedars followed with Estromate, we literally can have 90+% synchronization rates almost to the point where heat detection may not be necessary with lower cost semen, for example. And to me, particularly the ability to very effectively synchronize cows is very important and is almost as much a breakthrough to utilize some of these technologies like IVF, mass-produced IVF embryos, or in the future cloned embryos being able to go in. The ability to efficiently and effectively synchronize cows is very important for those kind of utilizations to occur. Embryo transfer, certainly we talked about some of the applications, how Transova has used embryo transfer. As we look at some of the key advancements over the years, certainly prostaglandin to be able to synchronize estrus for during superovulation has been important, non-surgical recovery, the ability to cryopreserve embryos, the direct transfer of embryos. Again, those are things that have been very important to be able to take embryo transfer up to a much higher utilization level that would have been used otherwise. And then, of course, we've got some emerging embryo technologies that we'll talk about next in terms of in vitro fertilization, sex determination, cloning, for example. If we look at AETA data, and I apologize in advance, this is a little bit of an older slide, but you can see there's about 175,000 to 200,000 embryos being transferred in the United States. So it's going to be somewhat of a significant number. And yet, if you look at the total number of cows between beef and dairy cows, it's only about 0.5%. So it's really only influencing the very peak of that genetic pyramid, so to speak. And if I look at our own embryo transfer business, we've had a nice growth in the number of cows we collect. To where we're up to somewhere into the middle 20,000 embryos being processed on an annual basis. And what's really surprising when we plotted this here a couple of years ago was to look and see that the number of fresh embryos were actually transfer actually has decreased, and that maybe the real driving function in the increases we've seen have probably been in our ability to freeze embryos. So again, sometimes the secondary things that come along, there may be smaller breakthroughs, are the ones that allow us to use these emerging technologies a lot more efficiently. In vitro fertilization is another tool in the toolbox. And in vitro fertilization refers to the ability to harvest oocytes directly from the cow's ovary and then be able to fertilize those in the laboratory, as opposed to with traditional embryo transfer where we let the cow do the work, so to speak. We do all the culture, the fertilization, and the culture work in the laboratory. And we've got a couple of ways that we can collect oocytes from cows. One is with a method where we use an ultrasound-guided needle to go in and actually puncture the follicle and aspirate that follicle directly from the cow. We tend to do that on our high-valued donors. But we've also got the ability to go to a slaughterhouse and be able to bring the ovaries to the laboratory and be able to harvest significant numbers of oocytes, where these oocytes are predominantly from Holstein breed cows for dairy purposes, or perhaps from a specific beef breed that we want to look at the ability to do some work with. We'd have the ability to do that. And basically, one goes and takes each of those ovaries and aspirates the follicle. And for those of you who recognize that is happens to be a pig ovary as opposed to a cow ovary, I apologize for that. But oocytes are collected. They go through a maturation process and a fertilization process. And then after the cumulus cells, the cells around the outside are vortexed off, you can actually see the one cell oocytes or embryos. And then they go through several cleavage divisions. And actually, we'll usually stop at usually around day 7.5 of culture at about that 9 o'clock period in that circle. And those embryos are transferred at that time. How do we use IVF? To a large extent, in vitro fertilization is used much like in vitro fertilization is used in women, where it's primarily for clinically infertile animals, so that we can go ahead and take cows that may fail to produce embryos by traditional means and harvest embryos that way. This particular donor happened to be a full-blood Wagyu donor, which would fail to superovulate and produce pregnancies, and we could produce pregnancies readily by in vitro fertilization techniques. One also has the ability to shorten generation intervals, where this particular calf's mother was about 4 months of age at the time the oocytes were aspirated and fertilized in the laboratory, so we've got the ability to turn generations more quickly, something that may be important in the future as we can do a better job of identifying superior genetics than we can today. Again, a tool that's there that may be used more in the future. And then the ability to produce embryos from pregnant donors. This particular donor came to us when she's about 70 days of pregnancy with 3 contracts for both calves. And we're able, between day 70 and day 90, to do aspirations. Since we don't have to go to the uterus, we're going straight to the ovary and bringing those back. Be able to do aspirations and fertilize those to 3 different sires and be able to fulfill contracts she had to both of us. And so there's interesting opportunities that we can do with in vitro fertilization. So for advantages, certainly first of all, we've got an entire class of donors that we might be able to get to, whether it's infertile or pregnant or prepubertal donors. We can collect more frequently. We can collect on a weekly basis with in vitro fertilization as opposed to every month or two with traditional embryo transfer. So we can actually make more calves from our in vitro fertilization technology. And then something that's interesting is really this last one that's here, which is the ability to extend the use of valuable semen. Here this spring, we had a producer that had some Angus semen that was quite valuable. We did a number of aspirations on donors, 30 or 40 donors, fertilized all those at one time with a single straw of semen, since we don't need very much semen in our in vitro fertilization program for fertilization attempt. And between 2 rounds of that and 2 straws of semen, there were approximately 65 to 70-some pregnancies that were produced on those couple straws of valuable semen. So another thing that is of interest, and also becomes of interest when we look at some other technology later, how it also fits into the biotech toolbox. disadvantages of IVF. Earlier, one of the big disadvantages was that some of the calves, about 10% of the calves, were larger at birth than normal. Fortunately, as we refined culture systems, what we found is that one's really literally faded to the background or disappeared, so to speak, is a real significant problem for us as we've improved our culture techniques with embryos, and we just don't see problems with our in vitro fertilization calves now. But the other thing that is certainly a disadvantage is, and if you remember, we looked at the slide where we see that a major driving force in our embryo business has been the ability to freeze embryos for our customers. Our embryos that we produce from in vitro fertilization tend to not freeze very well. And because of that, most all of these embryos are transferred fresh. We can probably have 35% to 45% conception rates are in vitro fertilized embryos. However, the real kicker is that we have so much variability in that we may have 0 on an attempt or 70 on an attempt, and we end up with some real dissatisfied customers on the ones that happen to catch the downswing in that variability. And so that's probably the biggest reason why in vitro fertilization isn't more widely applied. The ability to successfully cryopreserve or freeze those embryos, and I think we'll see an upswing in its use. Presently at our Sioux Center location, about a third of the donors are there for our in vitro fertilization program. Another tool that, or technique, and actually there's a number of tools in the ability to determine sex of embryos or sex of progeny, and there's a couple of ways to be able to do that. From an embryo perspective, we might look at the ability to go in and take a biopsy of an embryo, take a few cells off and submit those cells for PCR so that we can tell whether we have males or females, and then discard the unwanted sex that we may not want to transfer. Or the other option that we've had is the ability to use ultrasound to go in and image the fetuses and know whether it is male or female. But by that point, you can maybe make some management decisions, but it's pretty difficult to alter the sex ratio shy of actually going in and aborting those pregnancies. And that's obviously not a very cost-efficient means of determining the sex ratio. And so that's kind of where we've been, so to speak. And I think as if we get out a few years from now, we're going to look back and say that was the past and the ability to identify the sex of future progeny. And if we want to look present and future, maybe we're going to control the sex ratio with some other techniques. Separated semen or sex semen may be a technique that is available to us, particularly with some of the embryo technologies. And of course, cloning would be the ultimate form of that from the standpoint of being able to know exactly what sex is going to be produced of the calf. We've looked to use some technology from a company called XY Inc. in Colorado. I'm sure some of you are familiar with the company that has licensed technology from the USDA for the use of separating sperm with a flow cytometer. And the principle behind this is really that X-bearing sperm have about 3 to 4% more DNA. The X chromosome is larger. And so if that's stained with a DNA-specific stain that when a laser shines on it, fluoresces back, they can actually measure the fluorescence and determine which cells are the outliers, so to speak, and have more fluorescence, and those should be the female sperm. Trying to put that fairly simply. It's pretty amazing from the standpoint that sorting speeds of 25,000 sperm evaluated per second, with 3 to 5,000 actually being sorted per second in terms of whether it has a high probability of being male or female. And by high probability, we're talking about 90% accuracy ranges. And so that sounds like some incredible speeds. I can't believe the amount of decisions a computer's got to make to look at that and decide and be able to sort at that kind of speed. And then coupled with low-dose insemination of about 2 to 5 million sperm per dose could perhaps be used for artificial insemination purposes. Remember, typical insemination doses might be 10 to 25 or so million sperm in a straw, and so that this is a significant reduction in dosage. And even with that significant reduction in dosage, a single machine produces about 2 to 5 straws per hour. So it's obviously still a pretty inefficient technology to be widely used in artificial insemination, and so it's going to pick off kind of the peak top of the pyramid at applications that it might be able to find. In addition to things being relatively fairly slow from a sorting speed standpoint, this takes about a $250,000 to $350,000 flow cytometer and certainly a very quality educated person to run that unit. And so it's a fairly expensive procedure to work with. And yet, if we look at bundling some of these technologies, the 1 plus 1 equals 3 message, so to speak, if we take in vitro fertilization, to take the ability to use separated sperm, and then review our what we kind of want to be able to do with the dairy industry in terms of improved reproductive efficiencies, look to increase heifer numbers, and we've been able to take in vitro produced embryos that are at this point fertilized with both either non-separated or separated sperm, and been able to run in the 40% conception rate with those, whereas with artificial insemination in those large dairies, they're at about 18%. And I know that 18 sounds incredibly low, but when you take cows and put them into kind of situations and things that we do today that maybe they weren't necessarily bred to be in, et cetera, those are some of the rates that we have. It also gives us the opportunity to have a sustainable crossbreeding program. In other words, we can put a Holstein Jersey embryo right back into a Holstein Jersey cow, as opposed to what kind of rotational crossbreeding program do we go into? And then, of course, the value proposition we talked about earlier of increased female offspring, that heifers have an increased value in that situation. There may be situations that are going to come to mind that we can use similar technology in the beef industry. And then nuclear transfer cloning, certainly one of the real exciting technologies that has been out there. It's hard to believe that it's been, I believe, 6 or 7 years since Dolly was announced, that Dolly the sheep brought along from an excitement standpoint. And yet you've got to remember that, in fact, there were clones being produced before that from embryonic cells. But really the breakthrough in that situation came with the ability to use an adult cell, to be able to make an adult cell clone. At Transova, we primarily use cloning to produce transgenic animals. Dr. Robles is going to talk a lot more about those techniques and things coming up here. But and what our interest has really been is the ability to be able to do transfections in the laboratory and the ability to produce identical transgenic animals for some of these programs. And there's been a number of animals that have been produced. We've got a number of different groups of Holsteins that have been produced with the ability to produce human serum albumin. This particular group of calves is actually a group that occasionally, when everything works really well, the results are phenomenal. And there were about 80 transfers that were performed, and there was an excess of 30 calves that were born from those 80 transfers that were cloned calves. And we've got some of these now to the age of lactation, where they're actually into their third lactation, and they act and behave and are aging just like you would expect for cows at that age, and also producing a product such as human serum albumin in their milk. And then we've got calves that we've worked with Dr. Robel. These are actually embryos that he's produced, and we've helped gestate through the joint venture that we've got with Hemotech that he'll be touching base on. We've also used cloning to produce an endangered species calf. This is something that's more of a curiosity or interest for us, as opposed to something that's part of our business plan, certainly. This calf caught a fair amount of press when he was born. Unfortunately, he only lived for about a day before he succumbed to a fairly common diarrhea problem. About a year and a half later, we produced a Bantan calf. This was in conjunction with a group called ACT. The Bantan calf is also an endangered species clone. This one's done quite nicely and is now alive and well at the San Diego Zoo. And we occasionally get pictures at Christmas time and various things of the Bantan calf. So everything's going along quite nicely with that. When you really stop and look at this, it's pretty amazing that this particular calf, the calf in the back there, was. Came from cells from a calf that was born in the 70s, died before he ever had the chance to contribute to the gene pool. And so their goal with this was to be able to bring this gene pool back, so to speak, and have it contribute to their Bantan population. Again, a lot of our desires have been to look at not only the biomedical applications, but the agriculture applications. We've known that we've got to have increased efficiency. We've got to have regulatory acceptance before we can do that on a widespread basis. There's certainly been some problems associated with cloned calves. We've had large offspring. We've had placental separation. You can see a number of the defects we've had. And in fact, this happens to be, this is a pretty graphic picture, I guess, but this happens to be the umbilical cords. That's a very large cotyledon, or the buttons that you'll find, and some hemorrhage there as well in that particular placenta. And so we'll see some problems with some of these calves. On the other hand, we'll see a lot of calves that are very normal, healthy, happy calves. And as this is moving forward, I think we continue to see these at a higher percentage. And while it's not ready for prime time, so to speak, to be introduced as a widespread technology, there's a lot of times where this works incredibly well and works really well in a research setting. One of the other problems that we've had associated with cloning has really been the retention of pregnancies. This is data all the way back from 1998, where we started with about a 30% conception rate, which really isn't too bad. That would be acceptable. But the real challenge is the fact that one loses a lot of pregnancies from the time they're established until the time that they're actually born. However, if we look over the years and we look at pregnancy rate, we've had a remarked increase in conception rate. I'm totally amazed on a weekly basis when I see the pregnancy reports coming back from embryos, Jim, that Cassie sends to us, where we're having pregnancy rates of, 60 and 70% on groups of cloned embryos. But their ability to establish pregnancies is excellent. They do very well from that standpoint. We still see some pregnancy loss. We've got a little bit of a dip in one of these years, primarily probably because of some cell lines that were used. But overall, you can see that from that time period, you've got a calving rate that is more than doubled. Okay, so is it going the right way? Certainly. It's starting to move things forward. If we want to look at costs, those costs will really come in a few different areas. Embryo costs, gestation costs, survival rates, all are real important parts of the cost drivers. And I've got an awful lot of numbers on here, but if we can just focus in maybe on this bottom line and look as we slide from an efficiency standpoint, and as we see some of the doublings that we've seen in efficiency, it certainly decreases our cost by 50%. And where we started with clones that were maybe costing $26,000 a year to produce, we feel like now the efficiency numbers we're having up in this grid are probably highlighted in yellow. And so it's real possible these clones are well under $10,000 now. When one looks at the beef cattle industry and sees the number of cattle that trade hands for those kind of dollars, it's pretty easy to understand why there's an interest in this technique and technology. And a few years ago, we looked at a cloning cost and tried to project that out, and that's obviously a guess of where it would be, although I think we're maybe following that curve better than what we thought. And if that curve would continue to follow and hold true, obviously we reach a point where we reach a threshold where cloning could be used very readily. Again, that's assuming that regulatory and social acceptance is in place for that technology to be used. So cloning applications, order implementation, certainly with high-cost clones, the very first place and the places it's been used is in the biomedical applications. However, if we want to focus for the purpose of this discussion on agricultural purposes, really we've got to start with highly valued animals, such as the nucleus herd or top-of-the-pyramid animals, bulls with high semen demand, cows with high embryo value, insurance copies. For example, there's an interesting application here from the standpoint that some of these high-valued animals may very well look at cloning as an alternative to from an insurance standpoint, as well as show cattle. And then I guess one never wants to forget about sentimental value, because that does seem to be a real emotion that goes through some of our producers' minds occasionally based on calls I get. As we look down the road and would improve efficiencies more, how would we use cloning? Certainly replacement commercial dairy heifers. We've talked about a lot of the things that how it can be used, beef bulls for natural service, beef replacement females perhaps, and to begin with, it's used really at the top of that genetic pyramid, although I guess in some ways you could look at perhaps as it becomes more efficient, maybe AI and ET are at the very peak of that pyramid, and then cloning is our means of distributing genetics. We've cloned a few animals for agricultural purposes, certainly not very many. It hasn't been our focus with the number of cloned embryos we've been transferring for groups like Hemotech and the other project we're working on, but we have produced some cloned animals that are out there that are clones to some fairly popular popular bulls. We've also produced some ag clones from females that had an outstanding track record in their ability to produce progeny, and certainly that's an interesting application as well. We mentioned earlier there are times where this works very efficiently. This particular group was produced from about 18 transfers, and so you've got six calves. That's a fairly high calving rate on cloned embryos. And then the ability to clone a show heifer, for example, might be an option. And even show steers. We get a fair number of calls for cloning steers, and a lot of the interest comes from the fact that they may very well want to take that steer and use him then as a bull for semen sales purposes. And not that this was a candidate for cloning, but this happens to be my family over here on this side, so it's a good way for me to sneak that in. If we look at the current beef cattle industry, you know, we've got a fairly fragmented, segmented industry with a lot of producers over on that left side, and we like to talk about some of the fragmentation and things and the challenges of getting product quality and consistency. And what really amazes me about cloning is that some of the early dollars that went into cloning research really came out of the poultry companies, and there's continued interest by the poultry industry because they're interested in more uniformity. And I don't know about you guys, but the last time I was in a broiler barn, I'd have a hard time separating very many of those birds compared to when we were in a feedlot. And so the fact that they're looking at it both from a genetic gain standpoint and how they may be able to improve their genetics, but also uniformity. All right, we'll try this. Blows me away that they'd have interest in it compared to how we would from a beef cattle industry standpoint. We look at some of the financial or genetic return on cloning. You'd think that we would use cloning to first of all identify the perfect animal. Let's go find the very perfect Holstein cow that produces 50,000 pounds of milk and lactates for a number of 7 or 8 years, whatever. No mastitis, all the ideal traits that you might like to have, and that then we would clone her, that all animals would have the same uniform production, they'd be peas in a pod, so to speak, and that we'd be able to, have the maximum genetic gain. But I think in reality, if we look at it, and I'm certainly not a geneticist, but if we look at it, that phenotype equals genotype plus environment, first of all, the identification of superior animals will be a challenge. Particularly if we're going to put multiple traits that are lowly heritable together, milk production, dairy cow longevity, feet and legs, etc. And so actually the sampling may be one of our real challenges to find those outliers. And yet on the other hand, we've got the ability to sample several clone mates, so to speak. We could put them in varied environments or controlled environments, however you want to design the experiment. But again, traits with low heritability might be difficult. When we talk about uniformity, if you just look at really quantitative genetics and if you've got a trait with a heritability of 0.25, what I'm told is that you still have 87% of the variation. So we may not gain this peas in a pod thought that we might have. However, we also do have the ability to at least partially control the environment. And perhaps we're going to make animals in the future which are more genetically identical or going to be perform consistently, that we're going to match genotype to environment in the future more. And the other thing is that clones, that's not accounted for in this, they share the same Mendelian dominance, the same dominance patterns. And so perhaps if one's got the stars aligned, so to speak, it is going to carry through at a greater rate and have less variation than that 87%. From a genetic gain standpoint, one's first thought is that clones are a copy of something, so there's no genetic gain. However, if you really look at population genetics, you know, gain is made up of selection intensity and heritability of a trait. And there's a few things that clones help us with. We might be able to select more accurately because of the fact we can look at several different several clones as opposed to siblings. We can play with the environment. We've got the ability to challenge clones or do disease studies where you wouldn't be able to do that in a traditional progeny testing program, to be able to challenge with different things. Carcass traits could be measured at a terminal situation. And then, of course, increased selection opportunities. We talked about it, where one could go to the back end of the chain, so to speak, and clone a steer in order to capture that genetics again. Some of the other things, certainly the faster and more efficient dissemination of genetics from nucleus to commercial herds. I know that's something the poultry industry is interested in. I know it's something the swine industry is interested in as well. Of course, then with some traits with higher heritability, we talked about this before, where cloning is really the ultimate way of gender selection, so to speak, and so there's other benefits there as well. And it allows us to use a smaller percentage of the herd to produce our replacement females, for example. A lot of things not work here now. There we go. All right, and with that, we're going to move on, but I've got just one slide here on transgenics, which is the topic Dr. Robo is going to talk about. But I think one of the things that's interesting is, as we tie all these things together, all the technologies coupled with genomics that we'll hear about later, coupled with transgenics, et cetera, that this is a situation where really the 1+1 may very well equal 3. With that, I'd like to say thank you for the opportunity to be here, and certainly be around to answer any questions.